ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, Bonza becomes the latest small Australian airline to collapse, leaving passengers stranded. Also, the controversial release of immigration detainees is back in the news after a shocking home invasion in Perth. My guest is the Immigration Minister, Andrew Giles. And in Alice Springs, local leaders ask how federal government money to tackle crime is being spent.
And when families during the curfews were being spoken to, they were all saying we need support. So that means a level of working with community to respond to their needs hadn't happened.
Bonza has become the latest airline to try and increase competition in Australia's aviation industry, only to run into financial trouble. The first new local airline since Tiger Airways launched 15 years ago, Bonza started flying regional routes from the Sunshine Coast last year, but it cancelled all its flights today, stranding thousands of passengers, and it's now in voluntary administration. David Taylor reports.
As one social media user put it today, Australia's airline curse strikes again. Or as aviation analyst Geoffrey Thomas put it, Bonza's financial troubles are simply very sad.
A great operation, great business model, terrific team of people, very dedicated, passionate, professional. But it appears as though the rug has been pulled from underneath them.
Geoffrey Thomas is referring to a significant change in Bonza's cash flow. You see, the airline, the brainchild of former Virgin Blue boss Tim Jordan, was leasing four planes with the private equity firm 777 Partners and AIP Capital. Phoenix Aviation Capital has since taken possession of all planes under new leasing arrangements and grounded the entire fleet.
It appears as though the ownership of the aircraft has changed, so the leasing arrangements have changed, and on the surface of it, it would appear that Bonza's business model and the financial arrangements that they had come to with their original backers don't meet the criteria for the new owners of the aircraft.
That's another way of saying Bonza can't afford to fly its fleet under the new leasing arrangements. Geoffrey Thomas thinks it's sad because in what's been an historically very difficult industry to crack in Australia, Bonza appeared to have found some clear air.
They had plans to go to 20 or maybe even 30 planes. They were following a business model that was pioneered in the United States by an airline called Allegiant. And it's all about connecting airports and cities that are not connected.
Bonza was given the go-ahead to start flying regional routes from the Sunshine Coast in January last year. The company established a base in Melbourne 2 months later. Its business model aimed to link regional centres, often ignored by the larger carriers. Today, CEO Tim Jordan apologised to affected customers and said the airline was trying to find a way to continue operating in the Australian aviation market. But Transport Workers Union National Secretary Michael Caine says Bonza doesn't stand a chance as long as Qantas dominates Australia's airways.
What we have in aviation right now is Qantas, when times are tough, going cap in hand to the government asking for bailouts, and when times are good, like they are now for Qantas, telling everyone, get your hands off our profits. That has to stop. We have to even out these peaks and troughs. We have to support companies that are trying their best to carve out a good future for Australia in the aviation sector, servicing regional communities.
But is that a fair assessment? Well, fund manager Roger Montgomery says the airline industry is one of many in Australia with too few competitors, ultimately boosting profits for incumbents and leaving consumers worse off.
We see monopolies and duopolies form quite regularly across various industries. You look at the supermarkets, you've got two main players. Airlines, two main players. The banks, it's an oligopoly, there's four. packaging, you know, only a couple of players, building materials, a couple of major players. So across a variety of industries, what tends to happen is the point of stability in an industry seems to occur in Australia where two dominate and then everybody else is really fighting for the scraps. And for, you know, for decades, for as long as I've been alive, that's 5 decades, you know, we've seen a situation in airlines where there's only been two major players and everybody else struggles.
Minister for Infrastructure, Transport, Regional Development and Local Government, Catherine King, issued a statement earlier today saying she'd spoken to Qantas and Virgin CEOs and they had agreed to assist stranded Bonza passengers needing to get home. As for what happens next for Bonza, late this afternoon the company formally entered voluntary administration with accounting firm Hall Chadwick, giving the airline the opportunity to be restructured or sold.
David Taylor reporting. To Alice Springs now, and the Prime Minister says he's confident the $250 million funding package his government committed to the town a year ago will eventually bring the crime rate down. The money is to tackle social issues and Indigenous disadvantage. Mr Albanese has been meeting with community leaders on a 2-day visit. A few of them say they are seeing some good results, but others are asking where the money has gone. This report from Jane Barden.
Anthony Albanese today visited one of the Alice Springs schools, which has received money for programs to improve attendance. The funding comes from his government's $250 million package to reduce crime in the town. He declared the package, which is designed to tackle social dysfunction, is working.
The feedback, whether it be from women's support services, from the Aboriginal Congress about health, the school here about education, is all positive. The feedback that we had from the council was very positive.
The Centralian Middle School principal, Joanne Alford, says the money allowing the school to offer bush learning for Indigenous kids has helped.
Those funds have actually been transformational for our outcomes for our young people, so we really wanted to express our gratitude.
But since the $250 million was allocated to Alice Springs, crime has spiked so badly, the NT government recently called a 3-week youth curfew. Other community leaders who met the PM, including Alice Springs Mayor Matt Patterson, are asking what the rest of the money is being spent on.
We've seen hundreds of kids on the street after dark in summertime. I think there's a whole range of youth services in Central Australia. I think there's over 30. So we need to go back to the drawing board and say, well, we're funding this organisation. This clearly isn't working. We need to hold them accountable. Or where is the money gone that they said that they used for this program, auditing organisations that continue to receive federal government funding without delivering the outcomes that they're paid to do?
Substantial funding has been allocated to improving Indigenous-run health services and family and youth services. Organisations running those services refused interviews. Matt Patterson is calling on the government to break from its policy of funding Indigenous organisations to deliver Aboriginal programs.
We can't have just the same organisations getting money because it's all about the outcomes. Now, if we want young Aboriginal people getting jobs, it shouldn't just have to go to an Aboriginal organisation. The perfect case in point here is the Cattlemen's Association. Now, they've got a tremendous success rate of training young Indigenous people to giving them jobs and life skills, yet now they're not eligible to receive that funding because they're not an Aboriginal organisation.
The mayor has welcomed extra money for more temporary police, but says there are still other big gaps.
Police are using so much of their resourcing tackling domestic violence that it takes them away from other duties. And, you know, if we can put the ambulance on top of the cliff around tackling domestic violence, then we mightn't need extra police resources because they won't be so tied up.
Walbury woman Bess Price is the assistant principal of Alice Springs' Yiparinya Independent Indigenous School, where many children living in tough circumstances go.
The whole of Alice Springs wants to know where the $250 million has gone to and what have they done with it and have we had outcomes from it. You know, that's what people in Alice Springs are asking. You know, there are all sorts of opportunities in these town camps that could help these young people.
What's your view of non-Indigenous organisations getting some of that money to deliver programs?
I'd say yes, if they can make a difference. And I don't see why not, because, you know, a huge amount of funding has gone into these organisations to have youth programs, but we don't see any evidence on the ground.
Alice Springs are under Luritja woman Catherine Little, who heads the National Children's Advocacy Body, SNAKE, is also questioning funding priorities.
There has been a lack of transparency and accountability to community about that money and the programs it has funded. And when families during the curfews were being spoken to, they were all saying we need support. So that means a level of working with community to respond to their needs hadn't happened.
But she says Indigenous organisations are best placed to deliver programs to their own communities.
You actually get better results when Aboriginal organisations are able to deliver. It is not until you actually speak to the people experiencing vulnerability that you understand what it is that is needed to be able to fill the gaps.
The Prime Minister's countered criticism of the package and his policies by saying he's committed to winning the long game.
You don't solve intergenerational disadvantage overnight. It takes time to build these homes. It takes time to address social disadvantage. But we are committed to doing it, and we're committed to working with community-based organisations.
The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese. That report from Jane Barden. The Federal Opposition is again accusing the government of failing to keep Australians safe after an elderly Perth couple were the victims of an aggravated burglary, allegedly involving a former immigration detainee. Philip Simons was tied up and his wife Nanette bashed by the alleged offenders earlier this month. Police allege a former detainee, originally from Kuwait, was among them. He was released last year after the High Court ruled indefinite detention for people with no reasonable prospect of deportation was unlawful. The opposition's immigration spokesman Dan Tehan says the government must explain if and how the man was being monitored.
The worrying thing here is the complete and utter lack of transparency, because we were told that all the 154 hardened criminals, remembering seven murderers, 37 sex offenders amongst them, would be monitored and would have ankle bracelets. Now, reports now coming out suggest that this individual was not required to wear an ankle bracelet. Minister Giles needs to explain why.
I spoke to the Immigration Minister, Andrew Giles, earlier. Mr. Giles, what sort of monitoring was this released detainee subject to at the time of this alleged crime in Perth?
Samantha, thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak with you and your listeners. And if you don't mind, I would like to start my remarks by, of course, saying that my thoughts, I'm sure all of our thoughts, are with Mr. and Mrs. Simons at this time, particularly during their recovery. And perhaps I should also say this, I'm also going to have to be very careful, as you'd appreciate, in terms of my comments, as these relate to matters which are before the courts, and it would be inappropriate for me to comment on specifics about a matter that is the subject of a police investigation. But what we have put in place since the unprecedented decision late last year, which required the release of a number of people who had been kept in immigration detention by the government, was to put in place a community protection board, a group of experts, including former police commissioners, to provide advice and put in place arrangements for these people while they are in the community.
You may not be able to confirm it, but it's reported today that this man in Perth had breached his curfew conditions several times and that he wasn't actually required to wear an ankle monitor. That would suggest very strongly to many Australians that these measures are inadequate. So will the federal government go back and review the conditions all these released detainees are subject to and make sure they're strong enough?
We are continually looking at everything that we can do that will assist us in, and our law enforcement agencies in particular, to maintain the safety of the community. We'll keep looking at that. And as I said earlier, we've got a bill before the Parliament that would further strengthen our legal framework to deal with some of the issues that are at play here. But we're also keen to work with the people who are best placed to provide us with advice on these things. That's why we put in place a community protection board. And I'm sure you will appreciate that I don't want to make any comments that could get in the way of any court proceedings, and in particular that could have the effect potentially of denying Mr. and Mrs. Simmons the justice that they are entitled to.
I understand that you're saying you've set up a group to monitor the conditions and the behaviour of these released detainees. It's being reported today that another released detainee was in court in Melbourne yesterday, charged with breaching his curfew conditions and failing to maintain a monitoring device. He's now been released on bail. If you've got a group monitoring what's happening, do you think Australians will regard that as satisfactory, that this man is now out on bail, having failed to comply with those visa conditions?
Well, I should be clear that matters going to bail are matters of the appropriate prosecutorial authority, be it the Commonwealth DPP or the relevant state bodies. And it's very important, of course, that this is a system that's independent of political interference. I also might remind you and your listeners that we fought hard against the case which led to the release. These were individuals that we maintained in detention for all of the reasons that we've been talking about just now. And I think, as your listeners would well appreciate, no government is above the law, as the High Court has determined. What we have done is put in place a scheme and resourced that scheme to do everything possible to maintain safety in the community.
Mr. Giles, that's one thing I wanted to clarify with you. The opposition leader, Peter Dutton, constantly says the government didn't need to release all these detainees because of the High Court decision. Is he right?
No, he's not right. He's misleading the Australian people. And what's worse, Samantha, is he knows it. He knows that isn't the case. He has got to stop playing politics with this and start being straight with the Australian people, particularly on matters of adherence to the rule of law and matters of community safety. He knows better and he should do better.
Given this terrible crime, alleged crime in Perth, the controversy it's generating, the political damage I'd say it's doing to the government, don't you and the government need to be supervising more closely what's going on with these released detainees?
Well, on that, it is important that we put in place all of the resources that are needed for our agencies, our law enforcement agencies, to do their job. Our federal agencies, of course, the Border Force and the Federal Police, but to make sure they do so in coordination with the state police. That's why at the very start of this, we set up an operation, Operation Aegis, to get that coordination piece right. It's also why today I spoke to the West Australian Police Minister, Minister Papalia, to discuss this matter and how we can better support the victims, including if they wish to speak to me directly, to reiterate that that's something that I'm very keen to do so, if that is something that's of interest to them.
The opposition's immigration spokesman, Dan Tehan, says the government should be looking at, or should just be locking this alleged offender in Perth up under the preventative detention regime. Why don't you do that?
Well, I can say, and again, I can't comment on individual applications. I want to be very clear about that because I don't want to prejudice the success of anyone, as I'm sure Mr. Tehan should think about when he makes comments like that. I can say that applications are well underway to respond to preventative detention for the most serious and violent offenders. And again, these will be matters that have to be determined by a court, so I don't want to prejudice that further.
Andrew Giles, should you resign, as the opposition is calling for?
Well, what is absolutely telling is that the opposition are only interested in talking about problems, never about solutions in any aspect of this portfolio. I'm determined to get on with my job and to work hard at it each and every day.
That's the Immigration Minister, Andrew Giles. And the Prime Minister has said today he won't be sacking Mr. Giles nor the Home Affairs Minister, Claire O'Neill. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. Just a reminder, you can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, hopes are growing for a ceasefire deal in Gaza. Domestic violence survivors say new statistics showing the number of women killed by their partners has increased in recent years are distressing, but will galvanise their efforts to create lasting change. The figures from the Australian Institute of Criminology show there's been a 28% rise in intimate partner killings in recent years, bucking a longer-term trend since the 1990s of falling homicide rates. Researchers say economic factors could be a reason for the increase. John Daly has more.
As leaders discuss ways to end the violent deaths of women in their homes, victim survivors are hurting.
It's a hard time for many women, I know. It's a hard time for many men. I just want to say to all the people who have experienced violence, it's not your fault.
Lula Dembele is a survivor and an advocate.
And to all the people who have experienced violence and then gone on to do violence, there is a better way. And we need to be serious about doing this work deliberately and on the scale of cultural change that we need to achieve these outcomes.
New homicide statistics show a 28% increase in women being killed by an intimate male partner, with 34 deaths in the 2022-23 financial year compared to 26 in the previous year. Overall, homicides rose 4% in the same period. Ms. Dembele says this stark evidence is another call to action.
It saddens me. It doesn't surprise me in our current culture of male entitlement and the rape culture and the violent culture that is promoted, particularly online through the manosphere, when we have just come out of 2 years where our connectivity on social media has particularly increased.
University of Queensland Honorary Associate Professor Samara McFedrin has studied homicide statistics for years. She says the drivers of last year's increase in intimate partner homicide aren't fully understood.
It's hard to say, but it's reasonable to propose that life strains and stressful events could be contributing to that. So things like cost of living, for example, place additional pressures on people. That is something that could very reasonably contribute not just to intimate partner or to domestic and family homicides, but homicides overall.
Over the longer term, the statistics show rates of homicide amongst intimate partners has fallen 66% since 1990. Overall, homicides have fallen 52% over that period. But again, Samara McFedrin says that trend isn't well understood by researchers.
We've seen since the early 1980s ongoing downwards trend in homicide for male and female victims. There have been a lot of theories put out there, ranging everything from better social programs, better mental health support, and also economic performance we would expect to play a role in it.
One interesting insight that Samara McFedrin has taken from this latest data is that a significant proportion of offenders have had prior dealings with the justice system.
Among intimate partner homicide offenders, almost 6 out of 10 had some sort of history of domestic and family violence. So what this is telling us is that there are likely to be intervention points where we can more effectively disrupt that pathway from involvement with the criminal justice system, domestic and family violence, and then subsequent homicide.
As public rallies and calls for change on this issue intensify, so too are the calls for help. Lifeline received a record number of calls, texts and online messages on Sunday. Federal, state and territory policymakers are meeting in National Cabinet tomorrow to figure out a new response. Ms. Dembele says she's watched discussion and action on domestic violence ebb and flow over the years. She can't help but be a bit sceptic of this latest political effort.
And I want to be hopeful that we have the right political will to tackle this, but I am fearful that the same mistakes will be made because we are overreactive to the moment of now and we potentially abandon all of the good work that has been done to date that has not been fully funded and has not been adequately invested in to meet the scale of this problem.
Domestic violence survivor advocate Lula Dembele, that report from John Daly. And if you're in an abusive situation or you know someone who is, please call 1-800-RESPECT. That's 1-800-737-732. If it's an emergency, call 000. Hopes are growing for a ceasefire deal in Gaza. Hamas is being urged to accept what the United States is describing as a generous ceasefire deal. The new proposal has already been approved by Israel. It includes a 40-day truce in return for the release of the Israeli hostages and the prospect of displaced families being allowed back into northern Gaza. This report from Nick Grimm.
another retort from the armaments that have rained down on Gaza in a war that Palestinian officials say has killed 34,000 of its inhabitants. And as he makes his seventh visit to the Middle East since the October 7th Hamas attack on Israel, US Secretary of State Antony Blinken is talking up the chances for a ceasefire.
Hamas has before it a proposal that is extraordinarily, extraordinarily generous on the part of Israel. And in this moment, the only thing standing between the people of Gaza and a ceasefire is Hamas.
It's believed the Israeli offer would see the release of less than 40 of around 130 hostages still being held in Gaza in return for freeing Palestinians currently in Israeli jails. David Cameron is the UK Foreign Secretary.
It does seem to me there is now, you know, let's be frank, a pretty generous offer of a sustained 40-day ceasefire, the release of potentially thousands of Palestinian prisoners in return for the release of these hostages who've now been in captivity for over 200 days.
But while the tone might be more optimistic for the chances of a lasting ceasefire, the obstacles still in the way of the process remain substantial. Brian Katulis is a senior fellow with the Middle East Institute.
The Hamas leadership wants some sort of assurance that Israel won't occupy Gaza and take up more of the territory in the Gaza Strip. It wants some safe passage assurances for some of its leaders, though Israel has vowed to kill all of those who were responsible for the October 7th attacks. On the Israeli side, I think one thing that they've found it difficult to accept is the notion of a two-state solution, of a creation of a Palestinian state, especially at this moment when they still face threats not only from Hamas, but also Iran and its networks in the region. They often say that they don't want to reward this terrorism by giving the Palestinians a state. In my view, that's fairly short-sighted. It doesn't think through sort of the longer-term realities that peace and security is not likely to be achieved without some sort of sense of sovereignty for the Palestinian people and to make their lives better and a sense of control over their own destiny. Getting from here to there is going to be a very long road.
But others point out a ceasefire is essential for preventing large-scale famine in Gaza. Shibli Tilhami from the Brookings Institution is an expert on US policy in the Middle East.
If you talk to aid organizations, any of the major aid organizations that have experience and are or are involved in Gaza aid directly, everyone tells you that the scale of the need in Gaza right now is such that there is no way to get sufficient aid without a ceasefire. It's as simple as that. It's not just about getting a few more trucks in or a couple of shiploads in. It's also about the distribution. It is also about the safety of the humanitarian aid workers. It's about mobility within Gaza itself. It is impossible to do the task that is necessary to save lives without a ceasefire.
Further complicating the diplomacy, reports from Israeli media outlets claiming Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Defence Minister Yoav Gallant and other military leaders could be facing possible war crimes charges, with the International Criminal Court considering issuing warrants against them. It comes as the nation's top ally, the United States, has found a number of Israeli security force units have been responsible for past human rights violations against Palestinians. Vedant Patel is a US State Department deputy spokesman.
After a careful process, we found 5 Israeli units responsible for individual incidents of gross violations of human rights. All of these were incidents much before October 7th, and none took place in Gaza. 4 of these units have effectively remediated these violations, which is what we expect partners to do. It is consistent with what we expect all countries whom with we have a security relationship with. For a remaining unit, we continue to be in consultations and engagements with the government of Israel. They have submitted additional information as it pertains to that unit.
Despite the finding, though, the US says it will not impose sanctions against the units said to have engaged in abuses predating the war in Gaza and believed to have occurred in the West Bank.
Nick Grimm reporting. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. Just a reminder, ABC News Daily with Sam Hawley comes out each weekday morning on the ABC Listen app. Tomorrow, a look at how we've gone from predictions interest rates would fall this year to warnings they could rise again. PM will be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Things were meant to be getting better and easier, but now one prominent economist is predicting interest rates will go up 3 times this year. What a turnaround. A nanosecond ago, we were being told rates were likely to start falling soon. Today, Chief Business Correspondent Ian Verinder explains what's going wrong. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.